You were listening to Irish Radio Canada's Home and Abroad, and I recently listened to an audiobook, Plentiful Country, The Great Potato Famine and the Making of Irish New York. And while I would normally focus on the Irish-Canadian connection, what struck me when I listened to this was that while it may relate to the Irish in New York, I think it's telling very much a universal story, and particularly a universal story relative to the Irish who migrated around the time of the famine. And Tyler Anbinder is a specialist in 19th century America and the history of immigration and ethnicity in American life. And his latest book, which is Plentiful Country, The Great Potato Famine and the Making of the Irish New York, has just been published. And prior to that, he had City of Dreams, which was published in 2016, and that's a history of immigrant life in New York City from the early 1600s to the present. And prior to that, in 2001, he published 5 Points, and that's a history of 19th century America's most infamous immigrant neighborhood, focusing in particular on tenement life, interethnic relations, and ethnic politics. And his first book, Nativism and Slavery in 1992, analyzed the role of the anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic, Know-Nothing Party on the political crisis that led to the Civil War. Tyler, thank you so much for coming along, and it's an honor to have the opportunity to chat with you. Straight off, a lot of the research that you were able to conduct was based on details of individuals, their families, their background, their occupations, etc., that were recorded to some degree in a bank in New York, the Emigrant Savings Bank, which seemed to keep copious detailed records. That in itself to me was fascinating and powerful. And the level of detail I would have reasonably expected that you would have known how much each person deposited and when they withdrew. But the additional information was so wonderful that it led to this magnificent work. And thank you, as I say. Looking at your previous books, I can see where you came to this. So what is it that attracted you to focusing on the immigrant story?
Well, the immigrant story in general became an interest because, as you noted, my first book was about anti-immigrant sentiment in the United States in the middle of the 19th century. And so after writing that book about the anti-Catholic, anti-Irish, Know-Nothing Party, I felt like I ought to write something that gave the immigrants themselves a chance to tell their story in their own words. And so that was what led me to write the book about 5 Points, which was this the most Irish neighborhood in New York at the time of the Great Famine. And then New York became just a very Irish city at that point, but 5 Points remained the most Irish part of New York. And it was during the research on that book, towards the very end, when the records of the Emigrant Savings Bank became available at the New York Public Library. And as you said, these records are extraordinarily detailed. And the reason they were so detailed was the bank was afraid that people might come to their offices and impersonate another immigrant and steal their money. And so the bank decided to record lots of personal information about each customer. They took down, you know, for instance, your mother's maiden name. They're the first business we know of in all history that used your mother's maiden name as a security question. But they went way beyond that because, of course, lots of people within the Irish community would know the parents of the depositors and might know your mother's maiden name. So they went well beyond that. They asked, for instance, the name of the ship you came to America on, the date it arrived. They asked not only your parents' names, but their whereabouts. They asked your siblings' names and their whereabouts and your children's names. And that way, if you came to the bank to request money, they would use that to quiz you. They'd say, okay, if you're really Patrick Murphy, tell me the name of the ship you came on. And where is your youngest sister living and what's her name? And they use things like that to make sure you were actually the customer. And that the reason that's important is because all that biographical detail makes it for the first time possible to trace Irish famine immigrants over time. Historians previously were unable to track the famine Irish and see what happened to them once they got to America because there were simply too many people with the same names, right? There are thousands of Michael Sullivans and hundreds and hundreds of Michael Murphys and Peter Lynches and so forth. And so it's impossible once they arrive in America to know, to track any individual and see how they fared in America. But the bank records change that. The bank records give you so much detail about an individual. The key thing, especially being the spouse's name and the children's names and their birth order, that you could then go and track people over time using other records like census records in particular that I accessed on Ancestry.com. And that way you can see, okay, this Michael Sullivan, the one who came from Kenmare and whose mother's maiden name was Sheehan, he's the one who left and went to Boston and became a shopkeeper, and differentiate him from the other Michael Sullivan, even another Michael Sullivan from the same part of Ireland, who went to, say, Chicago eventually instead. And so this has enabled me for the first time to track the famine immigrants. And what I found once I tracked them was that they did far better than what we would have expected. The common story is that the famine immigrants were locked in poverty, that because of discrimination, a lack of education, a lack of resources when they arrived, that they were kind of stuck in the worst jobs America had to offer and stayed in them their whole lives. And what I found with this new ability to track the immigrants was, in fact, there was lots of upward mobility, and that the immigrants weren't trapped in poverty the way we've thought.
Not only were they not trapped in poverty, but I think what was it that those who were trapped in poverty were very much a minority.
Right. Only about a quarter of the, if we look at the men, for example, since women tended to marry and stop working, if we look at the men, only about a quarter of the famine Irish come to America, start out in the lowest level jobs, day laborer, porter, things like that, and stay in those jobs their whole lives. The other three quarters either never start out at the bottom, or move up from the bottom to higher level, higher socioeconomic positions.
The other wonderful part of the research, as you said, because the census records and be able to correlate to them, is that you were able to track the migration patterns that resulted from that, because the Irish who arrived in New York didn't all stay in New York.
Exactly. A lot of them stay in New York, but just as often, for everyone who stays in New York, there's another who leaves, and sometimes they don't go very far. They go across the Hudson River to Jersey City or Hoboken, or they go across the East River to Brooklyn or Long Island. But then lots of them go other places. The next most popular place after New Jersey and the rest of New York was actually California, which I was very surprised to find. But California was, you know, these immigrants are very ambitious. It's not just a random sampling of Irishmen and Irish women who come to America. These are ambitious people, and California seems to hold the most promise of upward mobility. And so California is very popular. The upper Midwest of the United States is very popular. Lots of people go there to become farmers, but then they go to cities too, like Chicago and Cincinnati and really all over the United States. The one thing you don't see that would, you know, interest your listeners is you don't find many who start in America and go to Canada. You have plenty of people who start in Canada and move to the United States, but typically not the other way around. And in part that was because the United States was seen as having more economic opportunity than Canada. But also, just as if not even more important was, you know, if you were in Canada, you were still part of Great Britain, and the Irish very much wanted to free themselves from the control of the British, who they very much resented credited for having colonized Ireland.
I think one of the other reasons that would have been, of course, is, as I recall, some of the U.S. ports literally closed down to immigrant ships coming in around the time of the Irish famine, which was why Gros Isle in Quebec ended up as the immigration center, which ultimately led to migration coming through that way also.
Well, they didn't shut down, but they were more expensive.
Okay. Right?
So it was more expensive to go to an American port because the British in part were subsidizing. I mean, the British didn't want so many of the Irish to go to leave Ireland, but if they were going to leave, they wanted them to go to another British colony. So they subsidized initially the fares to Canada. So it was much cheaper to go. And if you're a poor, starving, famine immigrant, you probably had enough. If you had enough money to leave Europe, it was to go to Canada more often than New York. But then the Canadians, as you and your listeners probably know, the Canadians got upset with all the Irish coming to Canada, and they imposed head taxes on the Irish coming, and that equalized the fare. And once it cost the same amount to go to New York as to Quebec, the Irish voted for New York.
The other fascinating results that you uncovered was there was a perception as well that the Irish would not have been great ones for savings and amassing wealth. And what you proved, I think, or your research uncovered, was that we were above the average to some degree.
Absolutely. So, right, the perception then was that the Irish were, these are the terms used at the time, slothful, lazy, that the reason Ireland was poor was because the Irish were lazy. They lacked what we would today call the Protestant work ethic, right? That term that Weber coined that hadn't been coined back then, but nonetheless, people understood the meaning of that term, even if it hadn't been officially coined yet. And so that was the belief among the English and among most Americans, is that the Irish were lazy and that's why they were so poor in Ireland. But what the story of the famine Irish in the Americas shows is that, you know, that proved that that wasn't the case, that it was, you know, it was the colonial rule of Ireland that was suppressing the Irish economy, especially in terms of its rewards going to the Irish themselves. Because once you put the Irish in America, the Irish do extremely well. And the bank records show this, that they saved plenty of money. Now, you know, they didn't have as much money in their bank accounts as native born Americans. And they didn't even have as much money in their bank accounts as, say, German immigrants. But they saved plenty and, you know, were able to use those savings in particular to start businesses. That's the thing that we most missed about the famine immigrants. And of the people who were immigrant savings bank customers, about 40% of them ended up as owning small businesses, saloons, groceries, things of that sort.
And also what was fascinating was in tracing the deposits that immigrants made was indicative of how they were being upwardly mobile, but then something might happen, be it a health issue or something else, which was recorded with withdrawals and no further deposits, that there was, excuse me, the ability to in some way extrapolate that maybe that a health issue or something had happened. And I found that also fascinating.
Right. We see that very clearly in the bank records. And then I was able to use other records to then substantiate the one's surmise that something must have happened health-wise. So I tell the story of one peddler who starts out in America doing very well, and his savings go up and up and up over the course of his first decade in America. And by about 1860, he has $1,000 in his account, which is the equivalent today of about $35,000, which is a lot of money for a famine immigrant. But peddling could be very lucrative. You know, it wasn't a very high status job being out on the streets in all sorts of weather, you know, trying beckoning customers. But you could make a lot of money at it if you were a good salesman and you were a savvy entrepreneur. So he saves up all this money. He seems to be doing great. But then one of his children gets sick and dies. And you see that right when the child gets sick, the bank the deposit stop and the withdrawal start. And then he gets sick himself, can't work for several years, and their bank account gets lower and lower and lower. He dies. And so by the time his widow and surviving children have made it to the end of the American Civil War in 1865, the account's gone from $1,000 to only about $200. And so, that was health was a very big issue, and could really sap a family's savings. But that was in part why you saved back then, right? There's no health insurance back then. There's no government social safety net. So a lot of people saved for that reason.
And what was also fascinating was the level of detail, and we talked about it a little earlier, of where somebody came from, who they were related to, who their mother's maiden name. And as I was listening to the narrative, all these place names that I'm very familiar with were popping up. And it indicated again how practically all of Ireland had representation in New York at that time. And also, as I could gather and see, was how some of that, the county affiliation and the importance of it, was also helping to draw people together and how they supported each other.
Very much so. Right. All of Ireland is represented in New York, that's for sure. Yet you find, weird anomalies there. So, for instance, there are very few Irish in New York from Wexford. And they seem to be going to, for instance, to Savannah, Georgia is their favorite place to go. There are relatively few people from Mayo and Galway, but they're overrepresented are places like Cork and Kerry. And then same from other parts of Ireland. There's a disproportionately large number of people from Tyrone and Cavan. And then not so many people from some of the northeastern parts of the United States. And those, I'm northeastern parts of Canada. No, northeastern parts of Ireland. Northeastern parts of Ireland. And those people from the northeastern parts of Ireland were more likely to go to Canada, but were also more likely to go to Philadelphia. Philadelphia had a disproportionately large population of Protestant Irish. New York, not so many Protestant Irish. Although there were tens of thousands of them, because they're just, so many hundreds of thousands of Irish, but relatively few compared to Ireland itself. And those things played a very important role. And you see that all throughout the history of the famine Irish in New York, especially in terms of jobs. People would come from a particular parish or townland, and the people already in New York from that place would teach the newcomers a particular trade. So I talk in the book, for example, about what was known as Morocco dressing, which was the term used to describe making cheap imitation leather from goat skin. And the people from this one parish in Donegal, Stranraer, everyone who comes from there gets to New York. They go to the same neighborhood. They learn this goat tanning. And they come to dominate that trade in New York. And then from Tyrone, people from one parish in Tyrone mostly become charcoal peddlers. And that can't be a coincidence, right? There's no goat tanning in Donegal. There's no charcoal peddling in Tyrone. These are things that they're learning in America because of this networking that goes on, that when you come to America, you find the people from your particular part of Ireland, and those are the people who help you get started. And New Yorkers don't see this. They see the Irish as just one mass of people, and they don't understand how many sub-communities there are within New York's Irish community.
Tyler, I could chat with you for hours, because this whole subject is fascinating and the work you've done is fascinating. And as I said early on at the beginning, this is a universal story. So while you have successfully managed to get your hands on the records of the Immigrant Savings Bank in New York, I would see that the behavior of the Irish is not untypical of what would have happened, be it in Australia, be it that whatever happened in Australia, whatever happened in Canada, what may have happened in other areas that the Irish migrated to. So very much a universal story.
Absolutely. You find the same story, right? And I've read the books that have been published on the Irish in Canada, and you find a very similar story that Canadians also feared that the Irish would be a drag on their economy and would become dependent on the government for assistance to survive. And in Canada, just like in the United States, the opposite proved to be the case, that the Irish were incredibly resourceful, incredibly ambitious, and also scarred by the famine, they were very determined to save. So instead of being spendthrifts as they were stereotyped to be, they turned out mostly to be the opposite. And as you pointed out earlier there, the percentage of their income that they saved was higher than that of any other group in the United States. And I imagine probably a similar story in Canada. They were determined to improve their status, and especially to improve the status of their children. And they succeeded overwhelmingly in doing that, both in the United States and Canada, despite the huge amount of discrimination that they faced that made such a thing very difficult.
We're going to have to wrap up. And in doing so, I do want to direct people to where they can get their hands on your work. Where would you suggest we direct somebody?
Well, all the major booksellers have the book. Amazon has it. Barnes & Noble is a big American chain. They have it. Independent booksellers have it. So really, any place you get books, you can find it.
And I'm going to wrap up with a piece of music that you may have known Mick Maloney. I get the feel you probably did. And it's a piece called Kilkelly, because it talks about the immigration story, Kilkelly, Ireland, 1840. And an Irish immigrant writing home. And the interaction, because that was the other part of the Irish immigrant story, and we have the Irish way. When somebody immigrated, there was never an expectation that anybody was ever going to see anybody again.
Right. So yeah, that was the expectation, that you would never see the people you left in Ireland. You know, the older people would stay in Ireland, and your expectation was you would never see them again. And usually that was the case, although every once in a while the Irish who did well went back and visited. So, but yes, for the most part, that was the case.
Tyler, thank you so much for taking the time. It's been a real honor and pleasure chatting with you.
Thanks for having me on your show.